Bob's Red Mill, believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Heritage Radio Network. This, of course, is the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today we are going to go a little nuts. We are going to be chatting almonds. I'm very pleased to welcome Gabrielle Ludwig. She is the Director of Sustainability and Environmental Affairs for the Almond Board of California. Gabrielle, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So I am super excited to kind of chat with you. Almonds, of course, as you are well aware, have been in the news lots in the last couple of years. But I thought it might be helpful to get us oriented to the almond plant itself. And I noticed from your bio that you actually have a PhD in plant physiology. So I feel like we have the right person on the line. I wonder if you can take us through in just broad strokes kind of the life cycle of an almond from kind of like seed to what I'm going to see, in my granola.
Okay. Well, I think the first thing I always like to say about what is an almond, it's basically a peach. And so it grows on trees, and essentially what we're eating is the inner kernel part of a peach, and that what we normally eat as a peach actually goes to dairy feed. But just sort of keep that in mind, that you are basically eating the inside part of a peach. In terms of the life cycle or the way almonds are grown, because we're talking about trees, they come from and they start in a nursery where they develop rootstocks and they develop different varieties of almonds, and they get grafted together, and then they get planted. This grafted tree gets planted out in the ground in the orchard, typically in the spring, and then it takes about 3 years before the trees start to bear fruit. And then the trees grow for roughly, on average, around 25 years until their yields decline that much that for the growers it's typically better to remove the orchard. So it depends on prices. In terms of sort of the annual cycle, that sort of gives you a sense of how the tree itself grows. In terms of the annual cycle, almonds bloom. They're one of the first things to bloom in California. We typically say they start blooming around Valentine's Day. You have a 3-4 week bloom period. And I should also explain that almonds, most of the varieties we grow, the pollen will not fertilize the flower itself, will not fertilize itself. So you have actually in each orchard two, most commonly three different varieties of almonds growing. And then you need bees or other pollinators to move the pollen from one tree row with one variety to the other tree row with another variety. So that's why almonds are and honeybees are so tightly interlinked, is that the pollen just won't fertilize itself in most of the varieties that we currently grow. And then, after pollination, this tiny little nutlet forms, and the fruit starts growing. And so essentially from about mid-March until about early July, the fruit is growing, And then we have something that we call hull split, and that's when that peachy part actually splits. It stays on the nut, but it splits open. It dries up a bit, and you can see the shell. And then harvest for the first variety starts around August 1, and depending on which varieties you have in your orchard, can go through the end of September. So there's over a two-month period, nuts of the almonds are being harvested. And then you have dormancy, and so that gives you sort of a sense of the both the life cycle of the orchard as well as sort of an annual life cycle. And I'm, if you have any specific questions, I'm quite willing to try and address them.
Oh, wow. That's a great primer. I guess my next question is, when the almonds are harvested, what needs to happen to them kind of after that harvesting process? I know, like, when I go to buy almonds in the store, I can get them raw or blanched or roasted, but can you just go out to a tree and eat almonds right off the tree when they're ready for harvest, or is there other steps that need to happen?
In principle, you could. I mean, the way we currently harvest the nuts is, and then the what we call the post-harvesting or the processing. So there's a couple of steps that are involved with that. First of all, just the harvesting, which everybody loves to watch, is the first step is actually this machine goes and grabs the trunk of the tree and shakes it. It's like this mini earthquake, and the nuts fall on the ground. And it's just like this rain of almonds. And then, you know, the machine goes on to the next tree. And then we let the nuts actually dry on the ground for a couple of days. That's what I call, we use solar power to dry the nuts. yeah, I know. and then they get swept into windrows, and then they get picked up. And then they go to what we call the huller-sheller. And the huller-sheller is, they say, the nut or the fruit consists of three parts. You have the dried-up peachy part, you know, the fuzzy part. And almonds, it's still green, and that's split open, as I say earlier. And those are the almond hulls, and those are valuable dairy feed in terms of from nutritional value. And then you have the shell. So if you're European and you have Christmas plates, you would have almonds in shell in your Christmas plate. And those are those things that look like pockmarked, I don't know how else to describe it, shells. They're not a smooth shell. So
right.
The first step of hulling and shelling is to remove the hulls, which you do by sending them through rollers and applying pressure, and that applies enough pressure to get the hulls off. And then you continue applying more pressure with the same kind of rollers to then get rid of the shells to get to the actual almond or the kernel, what we call the brown skin almond. And so from there in the processing, various things can happen. I mean, the main thing is it gets sorted by size and quality. So, you know, let's say the Japanese buyer may want some really, really big nuts, and so it will take several orchards to get enough together on that. Or like for a Hershey's Kiss, you may want a small nut, a very small nut. But, you know, basically buyers are looking for different qualities. And also I should say the different varieties of almonds have different characteristics. They taste slightly different. Some are good for blanching. Some are good for slicing and dicing. Some are better for marzipan. So in terms of those next steps, the main thing is to get to that brown skin almond. Many times that's all that happens, and then they get shipped to wherever they're going to be further used or processed. But in some cases, they can get sliced and diced. They can be blanched. That's where you put them in hot water and get rid of that brown skin on the outside of the almond.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can be put into various ingredients or snacks, you know, all the various things, the way we've been enjoying almonds recently.
Yeah, so I was surprised. I did not know that California was such a large producer of really the global almond supply. You know, according to your website, mm-hmm. it's about 80% of the global demand, which is there something particular? I mean, obviously, there's something particular about the California kind of climate or terroir that really lends itself to almonds, but I assume there's probably also, you know, organizing or kind of culture component that makes it such a great space for almonds. Like, what is it that that creates the environment? Like, what are some of the factors that create the environment for it to be such a large-scale producer for kind of the global market?
Right. So you're correct that, you know, California produces about 80% of the global supply of almonds. That number has been holding steady over the last, I don't know, at least 10, 15 years. So even though our production has been increasing, production elsewhere in the world has also been increasing. So the reason why California has been so good for almonds is a couple of things. One is just simply almonds like a Mediterranean climate, and that's a climate where it's cool and wet in the winter, but not necessarily freezing cold all the time. And then hot and dry in the summer. So that's your sort of typical Mediterranean climate. California, the Central Valley in particular, has that. And then the other couple of things that make California really good is, as I say, you do need a certain amount of chilling hours in the winter, which we get. But then it is one of the first things to bloom, so we can't have late frost. So a lot of areas, even if they have Mediterranean climate, they still get frost into March, and that's, at least with the varieties that are commonly grown, that the trees are not very happy, let's just put it that way. So that's part of it. And then, as I say, they actually like having it hot and dry in the summertime in terms of, you know, not having diseases and so forth. So that's part of what makes California work. The other reason why California work is the investment in the whole water supply infrastructure so you can irrigate. The story I tell is Spain is, well, it's been trading off different countries, but in terms of the top importing market of California almonds, but it's been in the top three for the last 10 years, often the top importer of California almonds. And it is actually the next largest producer of almonds in the world, roughly 10%. They have actually a similar number of acres of almonds, but a lot of it is essentially dry land farmed. I call it benign neglect. And so their production is much, much, much less than what we have in California. And that's really the main difference there is that investment in water and being able to irrigate. And then the third component that I think makes California successful is actually that investment the state has made, you know, the people of California have made to have a good university system, to have an extension system. So we still have, you know, the whole continuum of basic to applied to extension available. And that continuous innovation, that feedback between growers to the university saying, here's what we need help with and vice versa, that has also, you know, allowed the industry and the growers to continually try new things and figure out how to do it better. Or the growers try something and the university says, that looks interesting. Let us get the data to show that it really is better. You know, it can be that way around, too. So I think all of those factors together is part of the reason why California has become so dominant in the almond-producing world.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, I know there's almost, you know, it's like just shy of 7,000 almond farms in California. And, you know, it was interesting for me to see, you know, the Almond Board was formed back in 1950. And when they, you know, initially were formed, you were looking primarily at issues of compliance. And, of course, that has transitioned into you know, research and promotion and kind of other activities. But can you talk a little bit about what those compliance issues were and why that was kind of the initial thrust of the organization?
Well, I mean, this is the history more of marketing orders. You have federal and you have state marketing orders. And really the marketing orders typically can have up to three different responsibilities. One is, you know, setting quality standards and minimum quality standards. The other one is marketing and promotion, and the third one is research. So the Almond Board itself started really focused more on the quality side of issues. And really, when you think about it, what it comes down to as a consumer, and I can tell you from personal experience, I have that, if you have a bad experience with especially like fresh fruits and vegetables, if you spend good money and it doesn't taste good, or it's rotten or whatever it is, you tend not to buy it again.
Okay? Right.
I mean, you know, it's sort of evolutionary or whatever. you know, basically, adaptation and action. So part of the reason you have this whole marketing order system is that growers have figured out that it's actually to their advantage to pull together collectively and set standards for themselves, mainly to basically prevent the worst of the worst from hitting the market, because that hurts everybody in the marketplace. So, again, this is just in general for marketing orders. For almonds, I honestly don't know what the main drivers were at the time in the 50s.
Right.
But you certainly can have insect damage. You can have mold. You can have, you know, if you want your nuts, if you want to have nuts that look good, let's say on a cake, and you want the nice whole nut, you don't want a lot of chips and scratches. So I think by coming up with different categories of quality of nuts, you help the buyers be able to say, look, you know, for my purposes, you know, I really want the nice looking whole nut. So, you know, I want this category of nut. But if I'm making marzipan where I'm grinding it up with, you know, sugar, essentially, you know, you don't really care what they look like.
Right.
So that's right. Really some of the initial points of what sort of the quality standards and why they've evolved through this marketing order system. And then, as I say, the research part got added in the early 70s. And again, that was to deal with very high insect damage and how to improve that. So essentially it was a quality issue that got the industry to say we should be funding research. And that's been now in place for over 40 years. And again, I also think, coming back to your earlier question, why has almond industry been so successful in California? I think it's also because the growers have invested in research for over 40 years in how to grow almonds better and understand more about the almonds and so forth.
Yeah, I always think it's like one of those interesting things talking with organizations like this that are looking at a specific crop, because I think on the consumer end, you're like, an almond's an almond, and it just kind of shows up, and it tastes good, and I know about it, and it just happens. And so it's nice to kind of peel back some of the layers on why you're seeing these, you know, particular types of nuts and how they show up and what the kind of history and the impact there is. I mean, just from like an employment standpoint, you know, the California almond community is supporting over, you know, 100,000 jobs just in the state of California. So there's real kind of economics here as well. One of the things that I always think is so interesting about nut meats in particular is this idea of freshness and how having like a fresh nut can impact kind of the taste and the flavor. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about kind of the life of an almond. Like, is my bag of almonds that I forgot in the back of my, you know, kitchen cabinet, like, how do they go bad, or how do I store them, and like, where does kind of freshness come into play with the nuts?
So for almonds, I will say two different components. I mean, we have done studies because we were looking at trying to see if we could get almonds to be part of the MREs, so the military's food that they provide to soldiers. And to do that, you have to prove that a food can last for 2 years. So we have data showing that you can keep almonds as long as they're sort of relatively undamaged and, for 2 years without losing the quality too much. Now, what the advice I would give anybody who, if you buy a bag of almonds, to be honest with you, any nut, the moment you open it up and you have oxygen in it, I would start storing it in the refrigerator or the freezer. And it also depends a bit on the kind of nut. So, like walnuts, I would quickly store in the freezer because they are very prone to oxidation because of the kinds of fats they have. They actually have some of the fats that are better for you than almonds, but they also makes them more prone to going rancid. So my advice to anybody is if you buy nuts, especially larger quantity of nuts, once you've opened the container, store them in the refrigerator or the freezer. And that will help maintain the quality, especially avoid rancidity, which none of us really care for, that flavor we don't like. But the same principle, if you have an unopened bag of almonds and you've forgotten it in the back of your cabinet for a year or two, they're still quite edible. May not be the freshest tasting, but they're still quite edible.
Right, right. I get the impression that we that people eat a fair amount of nuts that like are not at their peak of freshness, because you always know it when like a great almond just like it tastes so good. But I feel like I've unfortunately had I've put more than a handful of like not so fresh nuts.
Right
in my mouth over the last couple of years. Well, I want to take just a quick break to hear from our sponsor. When we come back, I want to use the rest of our time to really dig in a little bit more to the stuff we've been hearing about water and the almond industry. So hang tight, guys. We're going to take a quick break. You're, of course, listening to the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
I'm Mike Colomeco, host of Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, as well as Ray and Tom Williams, who've worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray, Tom, why is organic farming so important to your family?
It's all a matter of the soil is a source of nutrients. You increase organic matter of the soil, you increase the water holding capacity. Water is becoming increasingly scarce. So in terms of sustainability, we don't think it's the only answer, but it's one answer, and it's the answer that we're trying to pursue.
It's been a challenge, and it's been fun because it is different, and we're learning how to do it for the last 10-plus years.
We're not just doing organic. We're doing organic to high standards.
Bob, why did you choose to partner with Ray and Tom?
Oh, goodness. Well, because they're the best farmers in Oregon, and they're close, and they have a bunch of acres, I think about 10,000, over in eastern Oregon and Washington. They're wonderful farmers, and their family have been farmers over there for many, many years.
It's really important that you have long-term relationships, and we've enjoyed a long-term relationship with Bob's because there are a lot of challenges to organic farming. You simply don't have as many tools as a conventional farmer, and so you have to rely on longer-term solutions.
Knowing that you have a market is absolutely critical. The margins in farming are not that great, so if you grow the stuff and you can't sell it, you have a real problem. And we know with Bob's that we have a market, and we turn out high-quality grains, and they buy them, and it all works well.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, we are back, and of course, we are talking almonds with Gabrielle Ludwig of the Almond Board of California. She is their Director of Sustainability and Environmental Affairs. And if you've been paying attention to the news at all in the last couple of years, you have, of course, heard some big and kind of shocking headlines about water and the almond industry. So, Gabrielle, can you maybe demystify some of what we've been seeing in these kind of clickbaity headlines? And what do we really need to think about and care about when we think about water use and almond production?
Well, I think the main thing you need to think about is it doesn't matter what you eat. There is quite a bit of water hidden in it if you use something called the water footprint methodology in thinking about water use. And really it comes down to the way plants work. I mean, this comes back to my plant physiology background, and that is for the plants to get nutrition from the soil, which is where they get a lot of their nutrition from, they have it dissolved in water, and they suck water up in through the roots and then move the nutrients up through the plant, and the water gets evaporated off of the leaves. It's called transpiration. And the same place where the water goes out, that's also where the CO2 comes in to do photosynthesis with. So I think what frustrated me in that whole conversation is, yes, almonds use water, but, you know, pretty much if you looked at the amount of water applied, and this is now a different number, if you looked at the amount of water applied, it was pretty much the same across all the tree crops in California. Maybe, you know, a couple inches different, more or less, for some crops or the other. But fundamentally, right, it's not that different. But I think the main thing people really need to understand is that almonds became the devil incarnate, is the way I put it, because we are now at around 1 million acres of almonds. When I was in graduate school, and I'm a little afraid to say how long ago that's become, but in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a 5-6 year drought, not quite as severe as this most recent one, but actually lasting longer. At that time, cotton was about 1 million acres in California, and they were the devil incarnate. So it really is just, as we have grown and become now one of the top three crops in acreage in California, you know, we're just more visible. And so I think a lot of it came down to just, if you're one of the top crops, then you're more visible. Okay.
And if you're one of the top crops, of course, you're going to be using more water, but you're also producing more food.
Right. Right. And so the other thing that we were able to, when we looked at the numbers, you know, I think two other things that I think were interesting is, yes, we've grown in acreage, but still we're using, of the total ag water usage, we don't use as much, trying to figure out how to say this well, but the percentage of land mass is larger than the percentage of the water that we use if you look at just the ag water use. So let's say roughly 14% of the acreage is almonds. We use about 11% of the water. But the other big thing is just simply, and again, this comes back to this focus on research at the Almond Board and that whole relationship with the continuum of basic to applied to extension at the university system, is just in the last 20 years, we have 33% increase in yield for the same amount of water applied. And that's through improvements in irrigation and nutrient management, variety selection, changing how we prune the trees, actually less pruning of the trees. So, you know, that crop per drop has really increased dramatically just in the last 20 years. And we're continuing to try and refine our tools that we give growers, really make sure that any water they put on goes as much as possible to the crop and not elsewhere. So, you know, it's been an interesting journey, I will say that. But also, you know,
it's very polite of you.
Yes. But I think it also made it clear how in this day and age of sound bites, how hard it is to, you know, represent information that's actually a much more complex story than what is there. But I think the main thing people need to understand is that plants use water. That's how they get nutrients. That's how they get the CO2 to do photosynthesis, which provides energy literally to the biological world, the whole biological world. And that pretty much anything you eat has quite a bit of evapotranspiration hidden in it. And so really, almonds are no different than anything else that you eat, to be honest with you.
Well, I kind of imagine like a funny comic where we get like upset with people for being composed of 80% water.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Well, so kind of on that note, I know that you have been doing some work around groundwater recharge. And can you talk a little bit about what that is and where that's at?
Yeah, so the California Central Valley has like all these pockets underneath it where groundwater can be. And to me, the groundwater recharge, the idea there is to put excess water on when you have excess of water available. So like this past winter was one of the wettest winters on record. The rivers are still flowing high. It'd be great to be able to take some of that water, put it back on the ground, and let it essentially trickle down to these subsurface water storage. And I think the way to think of them are pockets of water rather than a big cavern. It's not, it's more, there's a pocket here, but there's quite a bit of groundwater storage available below the soils of the Central Valley. And really the groundwater recharge, you have sort of, I call it two components to it. One is just trying to, especially during the drought, a lot of growers who had access to good quality groundwater turned to groundwater when their surface water supplies were diminished because of the drought. So the first step is just to try and, you know, put water back into the system that's been taken out of the system to help with irrigation or with drinking water wells, et cetera. But according to the researchers, they also point out that there's actually quite a bit of storage capacity that you could actually store groundwater or store water in wet years down there to use in dry years. So essentially think of it instead of having what we currently rely on, a dam where we store water behind it to use during the summer months, that we'd actually use the groundwater as a storage capacity to then draw upon, especially in drier times. So the idea is to really see, can you put water on the ground, excess water on the ground, and let it percolate down and refill these, I'll call them subsurface small ponds or tanks. So, and that's the recharge part. What we're looking at for almonds is really, there's a couple of questions for almonds while we're funding the research. One is just simply, there's a lot of acres of almonds, so it'd be great to see if we can use almond land where appropriate for groundwater recharge. And there's a couple of questions with where appropriate. One is just simply, you have to have the right soil type and below the, you know, where the roots are growing, you can't have a big clay layer that the water just moves sideways. It has to way to get has to have a way to get down. So one is having the right sort of soil matrix until you reach that first pond, underground storage place. The other one is just simply almond trees actually don't like, as I mentioned earlier, they like actually hot, dry environment. So they don't like what we call wet feet. They don't like standing in water for a long time. And
right.
So trying to figure out, you know, under what conditions can you put some excess water on and not hurt the trees? You know, easiest to do that in the wintertime during the dormant season, but you also have quite a bit of water. Like now, as the snow melts, really starting to hit from the mountains when the trees are already, you know, got almost fully sized fruit. So that's the other question we're trying to research. And then the third area you do need to pay attention to is, you do need to make sure you're not putting anything bad into the groundwater. So are you pushing nitrates or salts and hurting the water quality? So there's some sort of regulatory issues that we also have to pay attention to. But the gist of it is really trying to see, can almonds and other crops in the Central Valley, can that land where it's got the right geological conditions, can it be used in wet years to flood and to purposely flood and let that water get into the groundwater so that then you have more water stored for the drier years.
Wow. I feel I'm like that, like it's so fascinating to kind of untangle all of the different ways that
right.
Your organization and the education system and the research behind crop production like this. It's been such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much. I feel like I'm like on my way to becoming a novice almond expert.
Well, sometimes I think the professor comes out in me, I'm afraid. But yes, it is. I think I appreciate the opportunity to explain that it is a complex system that we're all trying to, that the growers are functioning in. You have this complex biological, ecological, geological, meteorological, and economic system that growers are functioning in. And how do we help through research help address the variety of issues that growers face?
Yeah, well, it sounds like definitely lots of work to continue on. So we will, of course, need to have you come back on another time to kind of continue the conversation. But unfortunately, we are just about out of time. Before we wrap up, I guess I'm just curious, as someone who spends much of her days thinking and talking about almonds, what is your kind of go-to almond consumption? Are you a snacker of almonds still, or?
Oh, yes. I would say the main, there's so many different ways almonds come in my diet. I mean, one is just, I like roasted, unsalted almonds just as a snack. But, I mean, just last night we toasted some blanched slivered almonds. I'll tell you, any salad is better with some roasted nuts in it, especially almonds. And then one way I've actually come to really enjoy almonds is to toast them and have them with eggs. So instead of having your toast, you have toasted almonds and your eggs. It tastes really good.
Huh. I will say that. I've never thought about that. Cool. Well, Gabrielle, thank you so much. Of course, it's the Almond Board of California. If people want to find out more, they have a great website with tons of information, additional media documents. You can get all you want to know, probably more than you ever wanted to know about almonds. It was so lovely to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, and thanks for asking me.
All right, folks, you've made it through another episode of The Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network. If you like what you hear, and I hope you do, please give us a rating on iTunes. Leave your comments. It really helps people find the show. Or visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org, where you can check out all 34 of our weekly shows. We, of course, are a 501c3 nonprofit, member-supported radio station. So that means you. If you have a couple of bucks, please consider sending them our way. You can do that by clicking the beating heart on our website. We've got some great swag. If you are down for a Heritage T-shirt and other stuff like that, would love to send something out to you. But most of all, thanks for listening and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.